This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The aspect of socialization of Ramadan, because Ramadan is basically community-based and community-centered. The congregation in the mosque, the eating together in the open, the sharing of gifts and the rest of it. All of these are to be restricted.
That's Iman Musa Dawood, National Coordinator for the Islamic Family Foundation in Nigeria, on how different Ramadan will be this year. Details coming up. Also, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta vows to arrest and punish people who escape mandatory coronavirus quarantines. And hair salons and barbershops reopen in Ghana's capital after the country went through a partial lockdown. These stories and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Uganda's lockdown to prevent the spread of COVID-19 includes a strict transportation ban. Anyone caught traveling without permission is subject to arrest, fines, and the impounding of their vehicle. But numerous citizens report that the ban has prevented people with health emergencies from reaching hospitals. Journalist Sally Hayden has been speaking with families struggling to access health care in the northern Uganda town of Gulu and talked with VOA's Jason Patinkin about what she found.
Since last month, we've been under a partial lockdown. You can only travel in a vehicle if you have expressed permission from the authorities. And so what that means is there's no provision for emergency medical care. So what you're supposed to do if you're having a crisis, if you need to get to a hospital, is you call the local authorities, like a list of numbers, and they will send a vehicle out to get you. But obviously they're very overburdened. They're not always answering the phones and they have a very limited number of vehicles. And a lot of Ugandans are living in areas that take quite a while to get to, you know, in villages with dirt roads. So there's a bit of a crisis in terms of particularly pregnant women, sick children, trying to get to hospitals.
So you actually met one family whose son died because he couldn't reach a hospital in time. Can you tell a bit about what happened with that family and with that child?
This boy who died, a 12-year-old called Stuart, and he actually died the day after the transport ban came into place. So he has been sick for many years. He needs regular blood transfusions. He has an enlarged spleen, and so sometimes it just happens that he needs to get to hospital. So the day after the transport ban came in, and it came in with 1 hour's notice, so it really was a shock to a lot of people. The next day he began to get sick, and his parents, his father and also a relative, brought him to a local clinic, which was 2 kilometers away. They literally carried him some of that way, and he walked some of the way, got him to a local nurse who saw him and said he had to go to hospital. And they tried for the next 8 hours to get him to hospital. And first they tried calling for an ambulance. They were told by the local authorities that the ambulances were busy, that they were picking up other people, and that they should try and get a boda-boda, a motorbike. And then they asked the boda drivers, but of course they were too frightened to carry anyone because they thought they were going to get arrested. So eventually they managed to get an ambulance, and he got to hospital around 6 p.m. So he had arrived at the clinic around 10 a.m. that morning. And after 6 p.m., before getting any treatment, he died. It's obviously been quite an upsetting story to report on. The family were really, really keen to speak out because they don't want this to happen to anybody else. And after all, like, it's their son that's died. You know, I was asking them about him. They said he was a really nice boy, really smart. He loved fishing. He was in a drama group. Of course, in any situation like this, you know, when coronavirus is such a big threat, it's easy to lose sight of the other people who are suffering. And it's important that we remember that, you know, this is a child that died and it was preventable.
this isn't something that is an isolated case of this one child. Could you go into about how many people actually have been impacted by this ban?
So the Kampala-based organization, the Women's Pro Bono Initiative, they've been tallying up cases of pregnant women dying, and they say that so far there have been 11 preventable maternal deaths. And on top of that, then journalists across the country in various places have reported on the deaths of children. So I've definitely seen reports of at least two other children dying, but the numbers could be a lot higher because these deaths are obviously likely to happen in difficult to reach places. One father that I spoke to had waited 3 days to try and get permission for his wife to go to a hospital to deliver a baby. It's worth saying that the president this week has now said that visibly pregnant women will be allowed to be taken to hospital even if they haven't got express permission, and that's a change this week. But women's rights groups here are saying, well, you know, if you're pregnant, you could need emergency medical care at any time. Like, it's not just when you're very visibly pregnant. And of course, that doesn't address the problems of children or anyone who has an emergency sickness that needs to get to hospital.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta has vowed to arrest and punish 50 people who escaped mandatory coronavirus quarantines at an isolation center in Nairobi. Some Kenyans who were forced to isolate in government facilities have complained about high fees to stay at the center. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Kenya's Health Minister Mutahi Kagwe called on the public to report individuals who escaped from the Kenya Medical Training College, one of the government quarantine centers in Nairobi.
An individual who you are aware, because there were even videos, who you are aware jumped the fence at KMTC, jumped the wall at KMTC, and is now with you. That individual is going to cost you very, very highly. That individual could end up killing your child. It is therefore imperative and important that you call the police.
Last week, some people in the quarantine center in Mandera County bribed their way out of the facility. Godfrey Otieno spent 16 days at the KMTC quarantine facility. The father of four says the government quarantine center had its challenges, and he understands why people would want to escape.
So these people don't understand why they're in quarantine. They see it as a form of punishment. Secondly, you are likely to get more infections there than you had. Thirdly, in a government facility, there is a notion that the government should take care of you. Because if you tell somebody from Kibera to pay 2,000 shillings a day, this person earns less than 10,000 in a month. How is he going to pay for that?
Francis Luchivia finished his quarantine this week after a longer than expected stay at a hotel in Nairobi.
The original instruction was we'll be placed under forced quarantine for 14 days. On doing the test at the quarantine facility, two people tested positive. Then they used that as a reason to continue holding us there, saying that we are continuing to hold you for another 14 days.
Luchivia paid 1,700 for his quarantine and was ordered to self-isolate another 7 days at home after his release. Kenya has banned public gatherings, imposed a nighttime curfew, and forced people to wear a mask in public to stop the spread of the virus. President Uhuru Kenyatta, speaking on Wednesday, said anyone who does not follow the directives should be taken to a quarantine facility.
Nandipo tumesema, ya? Watu kama hao, watu ambao wataendelea kukosa kutii sheria.
We are saying people who do not respect the set laws and regulations, if you are caught breaking the set regulations, I say there is no need of taking that person to the police station. Police have other jobs of protecting us, he says. If they are arrested, they should be taken to the quarantine center and stay there for 11 days. They break the law again, then they should be added another 11 days, because we need to do this to return our country to normalcy, Kenyatta says. Also, Wednesday, the government restricted the movement of people in and out of Mandera County, which borders Ethiopia and Somalia, after 8 coronavirus cases were reported there. Mandera is a 5th county where movement is restricted. The Kenya government has accused some people of not taking the virus seriously. COVID-19 has claimed the lives of nearly 180,000 people globally. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Muslims all over the world have been preparing to observe the holy month of Ramadan under lockdown restrictions aimed at fighting the coronavirus pandemic. Gifta Gariga from Abuja, Nigeria, takes a look at the mood of Muslims in Nigeria.
Ramadan is celebrated during the ninth month in the Islamic calendar. It is a time when many Muslims stay longer at mosque, fast during the daytime, and attend daily fast-breaking activities with families and friends. This year's Ramadan will be different, as Muslims in Nigeria have been restricted from gathering and traveling to stem the spread of COVID-19. Imam Musa Dawood is the National Coordinator, Islamic Family Foundation, Abuja. He advised Muslims to stick to the instructions of the Supreme Council for Islamic Affairs by staying at home during Ramadan.
The aspect of socialization of Ramadan, because Ramadan is basically community-based and community-centered. The congregation in the mosque, the eating together in the open, the sharing of gifts and the rest of it. All of these are to be restricted.
Dawood decried the lack of support from the government this challenging period. He urged the government to provide palliatives to cushion the effect of hunger during the Ramadan period.
There are challenges as long as people's lives are threatened. They will not be happy to obey the law. The masses are like children. Give them something to chew and they will comply.
Some Muslim faithful in Abuja expressed mixed feelings on observing Ramadan without the usual time spent praying in the mosque.
The experience to be encountered under lockdown as it relates to Ramadan cannot be overemphasized. This is because to existing norms that, of course, Muslims are subjected to under Ramadan, their freedom of worship, which, of course, the lockdown would take away. It's a government effort in trying to prevent the larger population from getting the so-called COVID-19, which is real.
As Muslim, the issue of lockdown and Ramadan is very unprecedented in the history of Nigeria and globally, because we have never observed Ramadan during this kind of condition.
Ever since I was born, I've never experienced life under lockdown. In the past, we used to experience Ramadan without any lockdown. The truth is that under lockdown is going to be hell.
Ramadan usually is a time of joy and people spend time outside praying together. This year will be different. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
Ghana this week lifted a 3-week partial lockdown in its capital, Accra, allowing businesses to reopen, including hair salons and barbershops. Critics who say it's too soon to relax the restrictions point out social distancing is impossible when someone is cutting your hair. Some Ghanaians, though, who during the lockdown lamented the scruffy state of their hair in social media posts and even tried to get home services despite the risks, are rushing to salons to regain their style.
In Ghana, salons and barbershops are social pillars and play a big part in the economy, according to Korko Ayisa, owner of natural hair salon Twists and Locks Salon. Across Ghana, services can come from street-side barbers in converted shipping containers to lavish, well-equipped salons. Ayisa says the hair business provides a way for many to support themselves, especially those without much formal education. She closed both her salon locations before the lockdown announcement to protect her staff and clients, but when the lockdown ended, she was inundated with inquiries about the reopening. Ayisa is following government calls to enforce strong hygiene and social distancing measures. Her spacious salons can keep clients well separated, and she has put measures in place, including frequent cleaning of surfaces and requiring face masks. While the stylists are not able to maintain distance from their clients, she is confident her salons are doing their part to keep people safe. But clients must comply with their measures, and her stylists can turn uncooperative customers away.
If someone refuses to adhere to the protocols, if someone is coughing and comes in and is not going to wear a face mask, they would respectfully, politely indicate to the client that we will not be able to serve them. And at that point, it really has to be understood by the client. If it isn't, it's not something that we're willing to compromise on, because this is an issue of life and death.
People have also been trooping into Kingsmen Barbers since it reopened after the lockdown lifted. Owner Salom Kluche says the three-week closure was hard on the business, his staff and clients. He had people contacting him during the lockdown looking for home services.
They call on the phone to ask, so are we working? Are we going to offer home service? And the thing is, we couldn't have offered home service because the lockdown was enforced by the law enforcement agency. So it made moving around, it wasn't possible. We just had to obey the law.
Since reopening Monday, he has also tried to institute a range of health and safety measures, including spacing clients and high hygiene standards for customers and barbers. Public health expert Nana Kofi Kwache from the New York University School of Global Public Health has been back home in Ghana during the lockdown period. Kwache was surprised when Ghana lifted the lockdown because of his concerns about testing and tracing. He also questioned whether there was enough analysis of the impact of the lockdown before it was lifted. He said that although desire for haircuts was understandable, there was still a risk of local transmission, especially given the impossibility of maintaining social distancing. However, with the government indicating a lower risk now, it was unfair to blame businesses for wanting to reopen, he said. Lifting the lockdown was in part aimed at allowing the economy to start moving, especially because many had suffered significant losses under it, he said.
People in the informal sector, those entrepreneurs working in barbershops and salons who survive on their daily wages, who survive on the daily hustle, could resume some economic activity so they could literally put food on the table, feed themselves and feed their families. So if you take for granted the government's view on the question of there being a lowered risk, then it's difficult to make a case for why they shouldn't be allowed to be opened if other sectors of the economy are actually open.
Kwache, who used to frequent a barber before the pandemic, says he is now, like many around the world, looking up YouTube videos for some do-it-yourself inspiration. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
Uganda's parliament has come under scrutiny after legislators allocated themselves a total of $2.6 million to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. Lawmakers say the funds are being used to feed constituents, but the High Court may order them to return the money. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Early this month, Uganda's parliament passed a supplementary budget of $80.2 million meant to support the fight against the spread of COVID-19. The budget included $2.6 million in pay to legislators, or about $5,250 to each member. Describing the payout as fundamentally wrong and criminal, lawmaker Gerald Karuhanga says parliament violated legal procedures on how a supplementary budget is passed, and says the money for members was smuggled into the budget. Karuhanga, speaking to VOA, argues that the $2.6 million should have been handed to the Ministry of Health.
What message are we sending to the nation? And when people are busy donating, and we can't donate for motive and that we can even easily take away, literally, even the food meant for a patient in intensive care.
Samuju Nganda, the opposition chief whip, says the money is being used to feed hungry constituents. Nganda says that before the supplementary budget was passed, their constituents were thrown in their homes seeking help, ranging from food to health service requests. This, says Nganda, shows how deaf the government has been to the pleas of Ugandans.
I am doing work that is supposed to be done by government. We gave them 59 billion shillings to distribute food relief to vulnerable people in Kampala and Wakiso and Mukono during the first 14 days of lockdown. The 14 days ended when they had distributed food in less than 10% of the targeted 1.5 million people. So here, there is no government in Uganda.
President Museveni has said that any legislator found distributing food to the public will be charged with attempted murder. One legislator, Francis Zake, was on Monday arrested from his home constituency in Mitiana District, central Uganda. The payout has caused an uproar among Ugandans. Nana Nalongo is a mother of six.
It makes me very angry. The things that Ugandans would think were the ones to be tackled by parliament, like put a voice for us to get services at subsidized rates, it's not what's happening. Health, food and water and power, we kept waiting. Will Parliament talk about this? They haven't done that. We wait for the talk from the head of state. He just makes it a comedy show. People are starving. We are having one meal when we had three meals.
Uganda's High Court has ordered the 2.6 million frozen until it holds a hearing on the matter scheduled for April 29th. On Wednesday, Speaker Kadaga summoned the Attorney General to advise Parliament on how to handle the matter as the money has already been disbursed. Halima Othmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Ethiopia has stopped granting automatic asylum to Eritreans entering the country. The United Nations and aid groups say the announced policy change, which went into place about 3 months ago, put Eritreans trying to flee the country at the mercy of unscrupulous human smugglers. Simon Marks reports from Addis Ababa.
For years, Ethiopia had an open-door policy towards refugees from countries such as South Sudan and Eritrea, earning it widespread acclaim among international donors. But according to the United Nations and humanitarian aid groups, Ethiopia changed its policy in late January without making an official announcement. The government no longer offers automatic asylum for Eritreans trying to flee their home country. The Ethiopian Agency for Refugees and Returnee Affairs told donors and aid groups earlier this month that the previous approach resulted in a high influx of unaccompanied minors, illegal migrants and others who do not fulfil the criteria laid out for refugee status determined under the international instruments, according to a letter seen by VOA dated April 9. Activists and aid groups say the new policy limits options for Eritreans trying to avoid forced conscription into Eritrea's national service program. Anne Onkont, country representative for the UN Refugee Agency in Ethiopia, said that in some cases, Eritreans could be forced into trafficking networks that smuggle Eritreans north through Libya towards Europe. She spoke to VOA via a messaging app.
The concern is really that underage children, minors, who don't have documentation, those are the ones that are at risk because they get caught up in trafficking, in smuggling, in these illegal movements towards Europe and elsewhere. All persons who come and who can be heard and their status determined and they have legal documentation why they're here, then that really mitigates the risks for them to be caught up in these nefarious activities.
Officials at both the Agency for Refugees and Returnee Affairs and the Prime Minister's office declined to comment. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed of Ethiopia and Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki struck a deal in 2018 to end the decades-long conflict between the two nations. Since that accord, the two leaders have met on a regular basis to discuss enhancing their bilateral ties. For Bereket Zumi, a refugee from Eritrea and spokesperson for the Eritrean Refugees, University Graduates and Students Association, anyone who is willing to flee their home in Eritrea is doing so because they feel their lives are at risk.
Every single Eritrean family is being affected by the dictator system of the country. So whoever is trying to escape and flee their own home country, they are just coming in fear of their own lives. Even those unaccompanied minors, even those families, whoever, those unaccompanied minors, once they get back home, they will be considered as traitors.
Beyond its new refugee policy, Ethiopia also has a plan to shut down the Hitsats refugee camp in the Tigray region, which is home to 10,000 Eritrean refugees. Onkont said closing the Hitsats camp during the coronavirus pandemic was not advisable, saying its residents could inadvertently spread the virus. Despite Ethiopia having locked down all land borders to stop the spread of the novel coronavirus, the UN has seen around 2,000 asylum seekers enter Ethiopia from South Sudan in recent weeks. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And on behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington, thanking you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.